Well, let's stand as we read Ecclesiastes chapter 5, verses 8 to chapter 6, verse 9. Ecclesiastes 5, 8 to 6, 9. If you see in a province the oppression of the poor and the violation of justice and righteousness, do not be amazed at the matter. For the high official is watched by a higher, and there are yet higher ones over them. But this is gain for a land in every way, a king committed to cultivated fields. He who loves money will not be satisfied with money, nor he who loves wealth with his income. This also is vanity. When goods increase, they increase who eat them, and what advantage has their owner but to see them with his eyes? Sweet is the sleep of the laborer, whether he eats little or much, but the full stomach of the rich will not let him sleep. There is a grievous evil that I have seen under the sun. Riches were kept to their owner, by their owner to his hurt, and those riches were lost in a bad venture. And he is father of a son, and he has nothing in his hand. As he came from his mother's womb, he shall go again, naked as he came, and take nothing for his toil, that he may carry away in his hand. This also is a grievous evil. Just as he came, so shall he go. And what gain is there to him who toils for the wind? Moreover, all his days he eats in darkness and much vexation and sickness and anger. Behold, what I have seen to be good and fitting is to eat and drink and find enjoyment in all the toil with which one toils under the sun the few days of his life that God has given him, for this is his lot. Everyone also to whom God has given wealth and possessions and power to enjoy them and to accept his lot and rejoice in his toil, this is the gift of God. For he will not much remember the days of his life because God keeps him occupied with joy in his heart. There is an evil that I have seen under the sun, and it lies heavy on mankind. A man to whom God gives wealth and possessions and honor so that he lacks nothing of all he desires, yet God does not give him the power to enjoy them, but a stranger enjoys them. This is vanity. It's a grievous evil. If a man fathers 100 children and lives many years so that the days of his years are many, but his soul is not satisfied with life's good things, and he also has no burial, I say that a stillborn child is better off than he. For it comes in vanity and goes in darkness, and in darkness its name is covered. Moreover, it has not seen the sun nor knows anything, yet it finds rest rather than he. Even though he should live 1,000 years twice over, yet enjoy no good, do not all go to this one place? All the toil of man is for his mouth, and yet his appetite is not satisfied. For what advantage has the wise man over the fool, and what does the poor man have who knows how to conduct himself before the living? Better is the sight of the eyes than the wandering of the appetite. This also is vanity and a striving after wind. This is the word of the Lord. So this morning, this is a big passage. There's a lot of stuff in here, and we're gonna touch on some of it, and I think home in on the main point of the whole thing. Everybody wants to live contented, peaceful lives, don't we? We don't want to be stressed out, struggling, striving to make life work, and if you really are kind of wired that way to want to live that way, you might need some help. Not a lot of people walk into my office and look for more tension in their lives. Not a lot of people say, you know what, I'm really content and that's kind of bothering me. Right? How many people come into your office, Colleen, with those kind of, you know, I really need some discontentment in my life. That would just make everything worse, not better. More things to strive toward. Most people want those things to be resolved and to go away. We want contentment and peace in our lives, externally and internally. But it's elusive for many of us. Just when we think we've solved things in our marriage relationship or with our kids, something goes sideways. We've been blessed with no vehicle breakdowns in the washer and the dryer working tickety-boo, and then everything seems to happen at once. The car starts making that weird noise, the washing machine pump starts going clunk, 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 and not draining properly, and you got to rip the whole thing apart and potentially curse the person that built it into a wall so you have to almost rip the wall apart to get it. Not talking from personal experience here at all. But don't things seem to just fall apart all at once? We saved, we got out of debt, and then life happened and our resources become barely enough to pay the bills. Just when we think we've entered a season of warmth and stability, the leaves fall, the temperature drops, and we're wondering, where, oh, where is the snow shovel? Do I have enough firewood for the next 4 months or so? Contentment and peace, we all long for it, but it seems elusive and fleeting. Is it even possible? Well, the writer of Ecclesiastes thinks yes, and it's both. Contentment is extremely elusive, but it is possible. Our text today is a little longer than usual, and it's complex as far as how it all fits together. We're going to look at something here. I'm going to put it on the screen. It's called a chiastic structure. Ancient Near Eastern writers and storytellers and teachers communicated very differently than we do today. When we teach students how to write even just like a simple essay, we've got, you know, you have to have your topic sentence or even just a paragraph, topic sentence, supporting statements, and then conclusion, which kind of restates the top. So we make sure the main point is at the beginning, the conclusion's at the end, and all the supporting stuff is in the middle. Well, ancient Near Eastern writers don't think this way. They have different tools in their linguistic and literary toolbox. And one of their favorite ones, and this is all throughout the ancient Near Eastern period, and various biblical authors use this from Genesis all the way through to Malachi, and it's called the chiastic structure. And the name comes from the Greek letter chi, which just looks like an X. And it's literally, X marks the spot. The main point is right smack dab in the middle. Great example of this is Psalm 23. Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. All the dead center of the whole thing is you are with me. And at that point, actually, the metaphor changes from shepherd to a king host. Whole other sermon, but in this passage, we see this too. So the name comes from the Greek letter chi, which just looks like an X. It's literally like this is a pirate's map, and X marks the spot. This is where the treasure is. The author is going to lead us to this main point. So he's going to say, okay, that's my main point there. He's going to go, here's one issue. Here's the B issue. Here's the C issue. Here's my main point. And now I'm going to back down from the main point in the opposite direction and cover kind of the same stuff one more time. So we kind of get led into it and then led out of it, but the main point is right in the middle. The main point comes in the middle. And to paraphrase this from Ecclesiastes chapter 5 and verse 20, it's this: people can live in contentment and peace because God allows them to enjoy their lives one day at a time. People, we can find contentment and peace because God allows us to enjoy our lives just one day at a time. The supporting evidence is mostly stated in the negative. People on their own under the sun without God's perspective on their lives will not find contentment and will struggle to enjoy what they do have. But when people do embrace the good things in life and enjoy them, God is at work. And when they strive and struggle and are discontent, God's perspective is just lacking in their lives. Well, we're not so ancient. Well, at least most of us aren't. I don't think many of us are Near Eastern either, or Middle Eastern. So if we just reformulate this a little bit, it's going to help us to kind of see the whole thing, because we're good Westerners or linear thinkers. A leads to B, leads to C, leads to D. That's how we operate. We go in straight lines. Ancient Near Eastern stuff goes like this. So this is just going to help us kind of thing, but we kind of need to take two sides of the passage then together all at once. So the first thing, so we got people, all the supporting evidence is kind of stated in the negative. People cannot be satisfied. There's just people who cannot be satisfied. You know that, right? You look around, there's people that can't be satisfied. This comes out, I'm not sure you can even read that, so I'm not sure if we need this at this point. Maybe just go back to that last slide, because that's pretty tiny. Unless you got good eyes. You need to see, go and see Alan. This is a sight test. You had to line people up with a sign-up sheet. People who cannot be satisfied. What happens when people just can't be content in life? They just can't be content with what they've been given. Well, for one, they are discontent. Thank you for stating the obvious. Discontentment, what is that? It's that hollow feeling in your heart that there's a gap, that something's missing, something's lacking, and it needs to be filled, and you'll do anything to fill that gap. The first group of people that struggle to be satisfied are those that practice injustice. Chapter 5, verses 8 and 9, if you see in a province the oppression of the poor and the violation of justice and righteousness, don't be amazed at the matter. I mean, yeah, no kidding, right? Just look at the news. These are somewhat odd verses, but they tell us something we already know, right? People in power, the basic message here is people in power look after themselves. Do not be amazed at the matter of injustice, for the high official is watched by a higher official, and yet there's higher ones over them, but the whole picture there is the powerful look after themselves. They'll look out for one another, and they'll kind of ignore the bottom people on the bottom of the rung of the ladder. And they'll step on others to escape consequences. We see this. The only real hope comes at the end of verse 9 where it says, for this is gain in the land in every way, a king committed to cultivated fields. The only hope in the situation where the government is so corrupt they just look after one another is that he takes care of the agricultural kind of thing where he makes sure fields are planted. And there was a provision for the people, the poor of the land, under the law of Moses, allowed to glean the fields and so avoid starvation. In the face of an oppressive government, the hope is just that they can get some food, but they're not going to expect much. Don't expect too much from government. Don't be amazed when you see injustice coming down from those in power. They look out for one another. That's more important to them than truth and righteousness. That's the main idea of these verses. They have to hold on to power over others, and it's really a black hole of insecurity. And we see this in the news all the time, don't we? And whatever you believe about the SNC-Lavalin case or the impeachment hearings going on down south, the reality is that the ruling class in any culture, in any level, is self-promoting, self-protective bunch of people, aren't they? And they'll take out anyone who threatens their power by whatever means they need to employ. We easily identify this in government and big business. But does this not also happen in smaller arenas of life? We protect our positions of influence, sometimes jealously, sometimes insisting on how much better we are at something than the next guy. It may not be injustice in a legal sense, but there can be a very real sense that we are trying to maintain a sense of control over other people, especially those who could threaten our sense of stability and control in our workplaces, our homes, our schools, and even our church. If you see in a province the oppression of the poor, don't be amazed. Don't be amazed. The author continues on, he who loves money will not be satisfied with money, nor he who loves wealth with his income. This is also vanity. The second group that can't be satisfied is those who hoard wealth, make risky investments, and who see everyone in their lives as a potential enemy. And therefore, they isolate themselves thinking they're protecting their interests and investments, but in the end, they can't enjoy anything or anyone. All his days, he eats in darkness, in much vexation and sickness and anger. What a stark picture when you can't enjoy what God has given you in life. To be alone in the dark, in vexation, sickness, and anger. Wealth and investments are a good thing. There's nothing in this passage to discourage wise investing and working hard. But where is it coming from inside? Is it from a place of gratitude for the gift of life that God has given, or is it coming from a deep sense of insecurity which is really a mask for a desire to control everything in life. Love money and you'll never have enough, says Ecclesiastes. Love wealth and your paycheck will always be too small. Continually stress out about your investments and you're not going to get a good night's sleep. Take a look at 5:11 again. Just look at this verse. When goods increase, they increase who eat them, and what advantage has their owner but to see them with his eyes? What is this about? Well, I think it's simply this. A lot of people think that if I just made a little more money, things would be a lot easier in life. If my business venture was just a little more successful, things would be a lot easier. Qohelet states the opposite is true. Amassing wealth and being successful doesn't make your life easier. Wealth complicates your life. More people get involved, the more money you have. When your business takes off, the demands are growing. You need to hire more people, and hiring more people means you've got to keep track of things differently. You've got to be more involved in quality control, navigate grievance, deal with interpersonal issues between workers, manage the risk of branching out and giving other people in the company more freedom to make decisions, and I'm sure the list could grow. You business people know this. A growing business comes with a lot of challenges, doesn't it? When it was just you and, you know, your garage, it was probably easy. When it's 15, 20 people that you're trying to keep working, it's a lot more complicated. Success isn't always what it's cracked up to be. It doesn't make your life easier. You become more visible in the community. More expectations are placed on you. You have more responsibility for those under you. And Qohelet's not saying any of this is bad. It's just that it's harder to find contentment and peace. I mean, if you're just the guy that shows up, works hard, goes home, doesn't have to worry about it, just show up to work the next day, hey, you can have a good night's sleep, right? That's what he says here. Sweet is the sleep of the laborer, whether he eats little or much, doesn't have all the stress. But the full stomach of the rich will not let him sleep. Can't remember who it was, one of the richest men in the world. I think it was back in the 50s or something. How much is enough? He was asked, and he always said a little bit more, a little bit more, a little bit more. Another caveat, being successful and wealthy does not mean that you are loving money and wealth. A lot of people can be successful, wealthy, and prosperous and absolutely be sold out loving God and his mission more than their own lives and bank accounts. Success and wealth are not the problem. However, there is a caution here. Caution that's echoed throughout the New Testament too. Right? It's harder for a rich man to enter the kingdom of heaven than for a camel to go through the eye of a needle. The worries of this life and the attraction of riches and success grow up and choke the seed that sprouted. Parable of the sower. There's some people who just can't be satisfied. And that'll take us away from being content in life and have a life of peace. If we can find satisfaction in the work we're doing, the lives that God has given us, that is great gain. There's another group of people. It's people who cannot enjoy what God has given. They can't enjoy the life that they have. This third group simply can't find it in themselves to just enjoy what they already have. And look at this. This is in chapter 6, verse 2. The man to whom God gives wealth and possessions and honor so that he lacks nothing of all that he desires, yet God does not give him the power to enjoy them, but a stranger enjoys them. God doesn't give him the power to enjoy them. What is that? Qohelet's blaming God for the situation if we look at that. This is in contrast to what he just said two verses earlier, and we'll get to this, that God's gifts, it is God's gift that people enjoy the stuff in life. But he says God has not granted this. And here we need to kind of zoom out in the broader context of what he'll talk about in the next number of verses. Chapter 6, verses 3, kind of towards the end. Qohelet is telling us a fictional story about a guy who had like 100 kids and lives for 2,000 years. Okay, just, you know, that's the picture he's saying. Here's a guy that's lived for 2,000 years, twice as long as Methuselah. So it's like way bigger than anything that anybody has ever experienced. And he's got 100 kids. I got 5. Like, that's enough, right? Like 100 kids? Okay. Newsflash. Hyperbole, parable, story. This isn't like literal. Right? Nobody's living for 2,000 years and having 100 kids. This is called hyperbole. It's not a real person. This is an exaggeration example story to make a point. You could have everything in life that God promises as blessings for obedience. See Leviticus 26, Deuteronomy 28. If you walk in obedience to me, your fruit of your womb is going to be blessed. You're not going to lack in anything. All things are going to be awesome. And you're going to live long and prosper. That's how you do it, right? But here's a guy who has it all and can't enjoy it. How is that even possible? This turns conventional wisdom on its head. Long life, wealth, descendants, and land, continual income, all of these were understood as blessings from God for obedient living. The problem, however, is you can't invert the process that God's blessing may result in these things physically. They can or not. God gets to define blessing, not us, and to argue from the effects to the cause that, you know, well, because I have a great bank account and my investments have gone well and my business is thriving, it must mean, therefore, that I am holy and righteous. You read Job, Ecclesiastes, turns all of that around and says, really? Even in the Psalms, it's not necessarily the way it works. What Koheleth wants us to see here is that God provides enjoyment of his blessings. Without God's active work in our lives, success and prosperity are empty and will leave us hollow and hungry. And how often have you gathered as a family around the Christmas tree? And how long does it take to get through all the presents? 15 minutes max? Even if you try to drag it out, I mean, it's like, you know, you've spent months buying the stuff, wrapping the stuff. You know, the anticipation is like, boom, and then it's like there's like wrapping paper all over the floor that you can't recycle. That's annoying. I have a fireplace now. That's where it's going. But then there's always the one who says, is that it? Aren't there more? It's like, yeah. It's not one, you know, there's always one who's going to ask that, right? And be upset, maybe, that there isn't another present under the tree. If we're honest, Christmas morning can be a bit of a letdown when all the presents are open and nothing has really changed in our lives. We got more stuff in the house and a pile of wrapping paper we can't recycle. Now what? And are we any happier or more satisfied with life? Has our contentment grown? What's the purpose? Or what happens when that gift isn't as awesome as we had hoped? You ever get stuff, and then you look at what your friends got, and you go, oh. Okay, so probably about grade 4. So, like, we're talking, like, early 1980s, late 70s. Star Wars. Really wanted the Millennium Falcon playset, right? Like, it was this big thing, and the action figures go in. What did I get for Christmas? I got the detailed model that I had to build with all the little pieces. I mean, it was like an exact replica of the model they used in the movies. Couldn't play with it, though. I mean, that thing was fragile. Sorry, Mom and Dad. I hate to bring this up now, and, you know, maybe I should be, you know, booking an appointment with Colleen over this, but... my friend Leon Potter got all of the cool stuff that you could play with. I had the model a lot longer than I think any other kid did, but, you know, because it went through different phases and it was really, really cool. But, you know, as a grade 4 kid, you don't really want some things, right? I have lots of other things, you know, in our lives that can be like that. As our minds relax, Minucius Felix in the 2nd century said, As our mind is relaxed by luxury, so it is strengthened by frugality, and yet Who can be poor if he does not want, if he does not crave for the possessions of others, if he is rich toward God? He rather is poor who, although he has much, desires more. Striving after wealth when we are not enjoying the life we have in the present is futile, and all that this applies regardless of your socioeconomic position. The key to ceasing striving is to rest in what God has provided. Contentment is elusive, yet even when you have it all. And so one of the last things we'll look at here, and I got to hurry up here, I hear the thunder already from upstairs. Seeing the good and seeing the bad. Behold, I have seen what is good. In verse 6, this is the evil I have seen under the sun. He's kind of, there's two sides to this coin here. The proximity invites us to read them together. Let's take the bad news first, because that's always a good thing to do, right? You want the good news or the bad news? Well, let's just hear the bad news, get it out of the way. Here's the deal with the bad news. We've already touched on this, but here it is again. The bad news is that you can have everything in the world that makes you successful in the eyes of the world in this life and still be joyless and isolated and unsatisfied. If you can't enjoy this life, that's bad. That's really bad. For what does it profit a man if he gains the whole world yet forfeits his soul? If all the stuff in life does nothing for you, if you can't enjoy the world around you, that's bad. It's vanity. It is a grievous evil, to quote Kohelet. And it comes down to the provision of gifting of God. If you have all the stuff, but God's not in the picture, if you haven't found a place of contentment, stability, and rest in recognizing that God has granted you life itself, then you're not in a good place. It's bad when you have it all and find no joy in life. It's just bad. Or what Kohelet calls it, a grievous evil. But see the good. This is what I have seen to be good and fitting, to eat and drink and find enjoyment in all the toil with which he toils under the sun the few days of life that God has given him. This is a good place to stop, grab your pen, circle the word God, and list all of the things that God does in verses 18 to 20. And these are good. And the list is simply this: enjoying the life God has given you right now, not the life you fantasize about, not the next job you think you should have, not the next house you're looking to build or buy, not the vacation you hope to take on or the car you have yet to drive. It is good to find enjoyment in the life you have right now. Right now. I want you to think about this for a moment. Does God know exactly where you are at right now? Every situation and stress in your life? Absolutely. Nothing in your life has taken him by surprise ever. Your current situation is completely known to him, and he alone knows what tomorrow holds for you. Can you accept the fact that God has placed you on this earth exactly as you are, born into the family that you have been given, uniquely created by his hands with his purpose, out of his desire that you exist today at this moment and have a relationship with him? God has given you the life you have at this very moment. As a gift. Underline those words in 18 to 20, gift and given. Look at this text. The few days of this life God has given him, for this is his lot, everyone also to whom God has given wealth, possessions, and power to enjoy them, to accept his lot and rejoice in his toil. This is a gift of God. For he will not much remember the days of his life because God keeps him occupied with joy in his heart. Let that sink into your heart. The center of the whole text comes in verse 20, embracing God's gifts in life. If you're enjoying the life you have right now, really enjoying each day and each moment, how much time would you have to brood over the stuff of your past or the uncertainty of your future? Time flies when you're... He will not much remember the days of his life because God keeps him occupied with joy in his heart. This is the secret to contentment Kohelet's offering us, being so enamored with the life God has given us right now. It's his gift. And that should put us at rest about what has happened or what may happen, because we're living in the here and now, not in the back then and not in the yet to come, that we can't change and we can't predict. And how many of you have connected with a friend from long ago and then had to review the life since you last talked with that person? Just this last week, got a friend request from a guy I went to high school with who's just been on Facebook just recently, Kent Gamowski. I haven't talked to this guy since like grade 12. Hey, how's it going? What's going on in life? It's been 30 years, dude. Like, how am I going to like pack this into a Facebook message? But it causes, those moments cause you to kind of step back and go, "What? Where have I been? What has God led me through? How did I get here? Wow." And does it, those experiences fill you with gratitude for what God has done? Can you look back and say, "Wow, look at how God worked. I wouldn't be here today. I wouldn't be doing what I'm doing outside of God working in my life and the lives of those around me." The life you have right now is God's gift. It may be hard. There may be challenges you don't want to be dealing with and can't see your way through yet, but God does. And if we really believe that all that we have is a gift from God and that God desires and delights in us, finding joy in His provision, you know what? Then Sabbath might become more central to our lives than working. We just rest in what He has given us today. I mean, how many of us can elevate hard work as the badge of honor over resting and rejoicing in God's presence and provision? Our culture elevates individual economic prosperity as the ultimate goal and being busy and promising us that that'll bring us stability and happiness, usually later in life, but not now. But listen to this. God calls us to Himself and invites us into His rest. He calls us to work beside Him, to see our lives in His hands as His gift. And in that we find rest for our souls. "Come to me, all you who are weary and heavy laden. Take my yoke upon you. Learn from me. For I am meek and lowly of heart, and you will find rest for your souls." That doesn't mean escaping the toil of life, but working alongside Jesus in the midst of it. Learning to navigate life with Him in His ways. Jesus doesn't call us to an impossible task that we have to do on our own, to prove ourselves to Him. He invites us to join Him in His work and to partner with Him, and in that, enter His rest. Contentment is elusive, but it is possible. In the midst of a world that is discontent and full of angst and drama bent on the promotion of self, the gospel calls us to rest in God's provision and His gift of life. Let's pray. Lord, thank you for this morning together. Thank you for the fact that you call us into relationship with yourself. Lord, thank you that, well, we can be all tied up and busy in our work and our responsibilities. And Lord, sometimes we just feel like we're going a million miles an hour and life can be stressful. Thank you that you have given us this life we have right now as a gift. And Lord, help us to embrace the giftness of life. The life that you have given us, the place that you have put us in, the people that are in our lives. And help us to just rejoice in life now and to rest in you. Lord, I pray for those that are weary and heavy laden, that life is just hard right now. I pray that they would come to you and find rest for their souls. Lord, I pray for those who are stressed out about just life and making ends meet. I pray that they would fix their eyes on Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith. Lord, I pray for those who are going through seasons of self-doubt, of wondering what life is all about and why they're here. And Lord, that you would speak to them this morning, that their lives are a gift from you, and you can fill them with joy inexpressible and full of glory. Lord, even though we walk through death's dark valley, we need not fear the evil, for you are with us. Lord, may we find our rest and our contentment, our peace, not in the stuff around us, but in you, who is our all in all. For it is in his name we pray. Amen.